The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
In Ghana and West Africa, lawmakers are seeking to criminalize homosexuality. The bill would also turn LGBTQ defenders into criminals themselves.
If you are a mother and you have a son who is a homosexual, this law puts a duty on that mother to report his son to the police.
But Ghanaians are pushing back. Also today, the wild bottlenecks of ships at American ports where it's go, go, go all the time.
I liken it to a car that has, you know, it has 100 miles an hour on its speedometer, and you can push that car to 100 miles an hour sometimes.
Same deal with unloading cargo ships. I'm Marco Werman, and an aging oil tanker off the coast of Yemen and the possibility of environmental catastrophe.
The spill will reach, potentially, key ports, along with all of the fisheries in the region.
All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for tuning in. The results of parliamentary elections in Iraq became clear today. With more than 90% of the votes counted, it's the party of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr that appears to be the clear winner. You'll remember that name. Sadr's militiamen fought against U.S. troops after the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Now, his party has won more than 70 seats in the country's 329-member parliament. But going into voting day, apathy was widespread. Turnout on Sunday was at a historic low. The World's Shireen Jafari gets us going today with the latest.
Polling stations in Baghdad seemed to be mostly empty on election day, and poll workers seemed kind of bored. Videos shared online showed small numbers of voters trickling into polling stations, many of them older Iraqis. Sunday's parliamentary vote was the fifth held in Iraq since the U.S.-led invasion that toppled Saddam Hussein in 2003. Turnout this time was at a record low, 41%, election officials said. Monitoring teams from the United Nations and the European Union were on the ground. Today, the chief observer from the European mission, Viola von Kramon, said voting day was peaceful, but she also raised some concerns.
Freedom of the media was not safeguarded during the campaign, following death threats to journalists and temporary closures of some television channels.
She also pointed out that some candidates use public funds to campaign and that independent candidates were often at a disadvantage because they didn't have the same resources. Still, by Monday, early results showed that the political party of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr had won the most seats in parliament. His supporters celebrated on the streets of Baghdad. And Sadr gave a victory speech. He said, "We welcome all embassies as long as they don't interfere in internal affairs of Iraq." Sadr, a prominent Shia nationalist who wears a black turban, has railed against the U.S. presence in Iraq. In an interview with 60 Minutes shortly after the U.S. invasion, Sadr described Saddam Hussein as, quote, "the little serpent," and he called the United States, quote, "the big serpent." Political analyst Sajjad Jiyad in Baghdad says Sadr's victory is all about good organization.
The Sadr election machine is very well organized. Their messaging is very good. They even had an app dedicated to their supporters to make sure that they knew how to vote. And they, you know, they mobilized by even sending people to individual homes and offering transport.
But Jiyad says that even though Sadr's political party has won a lot of seats, it still needs allies in the parliament to form a government.
So I think eventually most of the large parties will get a seat at the table. They won't be able to form a government on their own. They could dominate the government. They may be even able to nominate a Sadrist prime minister. I'm not sure what that immediately means for Iraq in the short term. I'm not sure if anything will change.
In the long term, he says, the rise of Sadr's political party could mean an Iraq that is more neutral towards both the U.S. and Iran. Nancy Azadin, an Iraq researcher in the Netherlands, says Sadr's electoral victory is worrying.
Contrary to what the Sadr party claims to stand for, Sadr himself has not been a proponent of reform in the past. He has defended some conservative policies in parliament that cripple women and human rights in Iraq. But he's also been involved in several service ministries like the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Electricity that suffer from endemic corruption and mismanagement.
Azzedine says it's still early days and hard to know what exactly this election means for Iraq and its relations with the U.S. and Iran. What will play a key role, she says, is Sadr's approach towards powerful militias backed by Iran.
And Sadr's position on this is not clear yet, since Sadr is a pragmatic character instead of an ideological character. So he will do what serves his interests best, and that we have to wait to see.
Iraqi political parties supported by Iran are already disputing this weekend's election results, saying the vote was, quote, a scam. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
A high-stakes summit to protect plants and animals is happening this week in China, the UN Summit on Biodiversity. The goal is to hammer out something similar to the Paris Climate Agreement, but protecting natural habitats. The World's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, joins me now. What's happening at this meeting, Carolyn?
Marco, this is sort of a stop on the road to signing this big framework on biodiversity. It's aimed at slowing or stopping the loss of plant and animal species over the next decade. Because of COVID, this has already been delayed, and the second half of the meeting where this document's actually going to be signed has been pushed to this spring. It's all under the auspices of the UN Convention on Biological Diversity, which almost 200 countries have signed, but importantly, not us, not the U.S. And it comes as the rate of extinctions on Earth is increasing. More than a million of the 8 million species on Earth are at risk of extinction right now.
That's incredible. What is on the table for this agreement then?
It's a pretty sweeping draft so far, but one of the key provisions is what's called the 30 by 30 target, which is agreeing to set aside 30% of the world's lands and oceans for conservation by 2030. This measure has pretty widespread support, but so far the host country, China, is not backing it. Alice Hughes is a professor in China and on the leadership of the, this is a mouthful, the China Biodiversity Conservation Green Development Foundation. She's at the conference this week, and she's hearing that China, you know, in theory supports this goal, but it really wants to make sure anything that is in this agreement is actually attainable for countries.
One thing China wants to see is that it is ratified because countries are actually going to follow through with it. And they would rather have a slightly less ambitious target that is achieved than something that countries think, well, I'm never going to achieve that, so why should I try?
So I gather something like that has happened before. The UN's Convention on Biological Diversity, it does not have a stellar track record. So that must be a concern.
It is. The precursor to this agreement that covered the years from 2010 to 2020 was, by its own admission, basically a failure. It set 20 targets for biological preservation between 2010 and 2020, including targets like cutting the loss of natural habitats in half. And none of those targets were met, according to the official review. And you can also just look to the headlines. 15 species were declared extinct in 2020 alone by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature.
That is going to be really concerning to see that number growing. So what do they hope is different this time around?
They're hoping that this framework, which has more monitoring written into it and more mechanisms to actually reach these targets, is more robust and more likely to be a success. For example, the draft of this agreement currently has supply chain tracking in it, so people and countries can see that a product was produced on deforested land and avoid buying it. So that's one example. And Alice Hughes tells me that there's also more political will on this topic right now because of the pandemic. Environmental degradation, habitat loss increases the risk that viruses will spill over from their animal hosts into humans. And so the COVID-19 pandemic has made biodiversity loss a more urgent issue for some.
We realize we cannot continue to basically run in a deficit in terms of biodiversity stewardship. We can't continue to deliberate. We need to see action now. So I don't think it would be too much to say that this is our last good chance, because for many species, they're already reaching the brink of extinction unless we act now.
So these negotiations will continue through the winter, Marco, and we'll see where the framework stands when it comes time for countries to sign it in Kunming in April and May.
The World's Environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
And tomorrow on the show, you may recognize the city of Kunming, China, from a different story that's made headlines over the past few years, the wandering elephants of China. They trekked hundreds of miles from their home and camped out in the suburbs of Kunming for a while this summer. It may be because of habitat loss or they were looking for food. They definitely want dinner. Now China's setting up an elephant canteen to help. That's on the show tomorrow. For pretty much all of us, the pandemic disrupted our working lives, sometimes severely. A lot depends, of course, on what your line of work is. But consider the experience of people who raise minks, the animals in the weasel family prized for their fur. Reporter Tom Carstensen has our next story from Denmark.
Mink farmer Knud Vest was born on this land 75 years ago, and he's run the farm for 50 years. Now he's a former mink farmer. That's because mink is an animal that can catch and transmit COVID-19. The fear in Denmark last year was that if COVID spread among the mink population, it could continue to mutate and spread to humans.
And just now we are standing here in the middle of the farm, which are totally empty. If we are lucky, we see a cat.
Where we are right now, I'm looking at a lot of long, very low, stable kind of buildings.
Yes. There's about 43 of them. There's 4.2 kilometer of cages, which we could have about 27,000 mink in.
Vest had built up a very successful mink business. Until last year, Denmark was a worldwide leader in the industry in terms of the quality of the mink fur and production levels. But overnight, that was shut down by the Danish government.
Denmark has announced it will eliminate the country's entire population of farmed minks after mutated coronavirus strains were reported among the animals. More than 15 million will be culled.
Meanwhile, not far from Denmark, in Finland, the mink industry was not forced to cull all their livestock. Kenneth Ingman is chair of the Finnish Fur Breeders Association. He says there they tested and monitored the mink population, and now a new approach.
We have developed a vaccine also, which will be used later this year. So we had to vaccinate the mink in order to be sure that the mink farming is safe for the public and for the animals.
Ingram says it's not the human vaccine they're using.
Our vaccine is based on the newest RNA technology. It's a totally new vaccine.
He says the Finnish government is not footing the bill.
The farmers themselves are paying, and also the Farmers Association paying for the whole project.
So nothing from the government?
No, not a penny.
Ingram says these vaccines are not taking anything away from humans. This is also a way to protect the public. Meanwhile, in the US, states like Wisconsin and Oregon are also working on programs to vaccinate mink. According to the CDC, there's no evidence right now that the mink are playing a significant role in the spread of COVID-19 to people. In Denmark, an inquiry commission is digging into the handling of the mink cull, and there's a lot of anger within the mink farming community. Former mink farmer Knud Vest is particularly mad at the Prime Minister.
She should have been kicked out of the parliament, and she should be in jail when this is over. That's how I see it. This is totally unacceptable what she has done to us.
Vest has been reimbursed about $5 per mink he killed, a sort of bonus for doing it quickly. That's about $100,000 in his case.
But it took half a year to find out to pay that. And that's the only money we have got so far.
The actual compensation is likely to take up to 3 years. And whilst the government has softened on the matter of allowing mink production in Denmark again, all the animals, including the breeding stock, are gone.
So what does the future for mink farming in Denmark look like?
I will say it's nearly zero.
The organization for mink farmers is more or less shut down. Knud Vest has other ideas for his future, as he is close to the waterfront and close to the capital.
We will see if we can make some B&B or maybe some other kind of holiday apartments and different things of that kind. We have to rethink totally, and we do that.
Mink farmers that do want to continue are looking at moving to countries like Russia and Ukraine. For The World, I'm Tom Carstensen in Denmark.
Just ahead, a rusting oil tanker sits off the shore of war-torn Yemen. It is filled with oil, a colossal worry if it were to spring a leak.
Normally, if you have an oil tanker like this, you could just get the authorities to remove the oil off the boat. But it's very difficult to negotiate the tanker when you have two sides at war.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A court in The Hague today issued a ruling on a long-running dispute between Kenya and Somalia. At issue is the maritime border between the two East African neighbors. For years, it's been a point of contention. At times, it's even led Kenya and Somalia to cut off diplomatic relations. Today's ruling comes from the United Nations International Court of Justice. As the world's Africa correspondent Halima Gikande reports, it could have big implications for both countries.
Kenya and Somalia share a land border, but they've been arguing over a triangular section of the Indian Ocean off both of their coasts. It's believed to be rich in offshore oil, natural gas, and other resources. Ifesinanche Okafor-Yarwood teaches African maritime security at the University of St. Andrews in the UK. She says maritime disputes are becoming more and more of a contentious issue across Africa.
When countries have seen the potential of either offshore hydrocarbon or fisheries resources, which is then making them to become more interested in their maritime boundaries and the resources within it.
Hydrocarbon and fishing resources are big business. The disagreement between Kenya and Somalia boils down to this. Where do you draw the dividing line across the ocean? After multiple failed attempts at negotiation over the years, Somalia sued Kenya at the International Court of Justice in 2014. Today came the verdict, read out by ICJ President Judge Joan Donahue.
Unanimously decides that the starting point of the single maritime boundary delimiting the respective maritime areas between the Federal Republic of Somalia and the Republic of Kenya is the intersection of the straight line extending from the final.
Essentially, the court took the disputed maritime triangle and cut it in half, calling it an equitable decision. Online, people were quick to cast this as a major win for Somalia, but not so fast. Kenya has been pretty clear about how it sees the international court. Here's Kenyan Foreign Affairs official Macharia Kamau speaking last week.
The delivery of the judgment will be the culmination of a flawed judicial process that Kenya has had reservations with and withdrawn from.
Kenya has accused the court of being biased, said it had no jurisdiction, and that the country will not recognize this judgment. Kenya also warned it could have a profound impact on security, politics, and the economy in the region. Ifesinanche Okafor-Yarwood, the maritime security expert, says that's a valid concern.
And if you're not, if you can't talk through disputes such as dispute over your boundaries, how can you then sit together and collaborate on other issues?
Issues like piracy, human trafficking, and illegal fishing. Those require collaboration. There are also concerns that a continued border dispute could impact the fight against terrorism in the region. Kenya has troops in Somalia fighting against al-Shabaab. Okafor-Yarwood says the countries need to start looking for other solutions to handle these maritime disputes, like joint management agreements.
So joint management agreement or arrangement is just two countries coming together to agree that they would manage the resources in the disputed area jointly.
She says this would be a much better approach than expensive, drawn-out legal fights over boundaries that might never be resolved. Case in point, today's court verdict is final but not really enforceable. So all eyes will be on what the two countries do next. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
5 miles off the coast of Yemen in the Red Sea, there's a rusting oil tanker. It's been compared to a ticking time bomb. That's because its cargo is 1 million barrels of crude oil waiting to explode or pour out into a spill that could potentially be 4 times the size of the 1989 Exxon Valdez disaster off the coast of Alaska. UN inspectors have been trying to gain access to the 45-year-old ship known as the FSO Safar, but their efforts have been stymied by the ongoing war in Yemen. Ben Huynh is a Stanford University researcher and lead author of a paper published this week in the journal Nature Sustainability, Public Health Impacts of an Imminent Red Sea Oil Spill is its title. Ben joins us from his home in California. Ben, tell us about the Safar. What makes it such an environmental risk right now?
I think that people can intuitively grasp that a massive oil spill of unprecedented size is an environmental risk. You know, like we have these intuitive images of birds getting oil in their feathers or fish dying out. But I think what's very unique about this situation and very concerning is the humanitarian crisis that it poses.
Talk about that, because I know you and your colleagues came up with computer models to help you picture the results of an oil spill from specifically this vessel, the Soffer, what would the human impact be if, say, there is an oil spill?
All of Yemen's humanitarian aid comes through a handful of key ports, and the vast majority of the population in Yemen is dependent on those key ports for this humanitarian aid. So when these ports will close because of the oil spill, then millions of people will go without food and clean water. 10 million people in terms of drinking water, around 8 million in terms of losing food. If you're asking ecological or environmental damage, that's the entire Red Sea region. So that's hundreds of millions of people.
How does your computer model actually work?
Essentially, you can model one spill at a time based on environmental conditions, based on how the waves are moving at a certain time, how the currents are, how the tides are, the temperature, the salinity. So we have historical data ranging back years and years. And what we do is that we simulate spills over historical data thousands and thousands of times. And we can see sort of an average or an expectation of where the spill might go. And we overlay those on top of each other to get a better idea of the potential spill area.
And what does your computer model show us about the FSO Soffer right now?
It's very possible that the spill could flow north up into Saudi Arabia. It could go into Eritrea. It can go towards Djibouti. And of course, all along the western edge of Yemen, along with all of the fisheries in the region.
You mentioned earlier the lack of food and water at the ports. How would closing Yemen's Red Sea ports stop Yemenis from having water?
It would stop them from having water in two ways. The first primary way is fuel. Fuel comes in primarily through those ports along the Red Sea. And most services in Yemen run on fuel. So these are the water pumps, the pumps to create water from the wells, or to truck the water from the ports to locations where people might need the water. So that's responsible for around drinking water, responsible for around 8 million people. On top of that, there are desalination plants in the area that we modeled where the oil might reach those plants, contaminating them, preventing clean water from being produced.
Again, this has not happened yet, and we're waiting to see what does happen to the Soffer. In the midst of war in Yemen, what is the political component here?
So it's very difficult to actually disentangle the issue of the Soffer between the conflict that's going on in the region. Because normally, if you have an oil tanker like this, you could just get the authorities to remove the oil off the boat. But the issue here is that it's very difficult to negotiate the tanker when you have two sides at war.
Are you hopeful that there will be a scenario that is less consequential than an oil spill or an explosion?
Yes, I'm very hopeful. I think that the international community can and should feel very invested that it will be a very strong humanitarian crisis if we do not act in time. And we're hoping that this study adds a layer of urgency to people, impelling people to act. So yes, I believe that we still have time. The spill can be prevented, and I truly hope that it is prevented.
Ben Nguyen is a biomedical researcher at Stanford University. He was telling us about the potential human cost of an oil spill from a rusting tanker, the FSO Soffer, off the coast of Yemen. Ben, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so much.
More stories from around the globe are coming up. You're with the world. We all know it's hard to get things done on Capitol Hill, but a holdup on ambassador nominations is taking Washington inefficiency to whole new heights.
We have only two ambassadors, one to the United Nations, one the ambassador to Mexico, have been confirmed and are in place for this administration.
How and why one senator from Texas is gumming up the system. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In recent years, we've heard a lot about migrants making the dangerous trek through the Darien Gap, the remote and dangerous wilderness between Colombia and Panama. There are no roads there, and that route is now seeing a record number of children among the migrants traveling north. Figures released this week by UNICEF estimate that more than 19,000 kids have slogged through that jungle in the past 9 months. The children are making the journey at the mercy of human traffickers who control the route. Laurent Duvilliers is UNICEF's regional chief of communications. He joins us from Panama City. Nearly 20,000 children have made this dangerous trek this year, Laurent. Nearly three times the number estimated for the past 5 years combined. How do you explain this?
The children there are being exposed to wild animals, insects, lack of water, but also robbery, extortion, and unfortunately, sexual violence. So it's extremely dangerous for the children. And we've been talking to many families, and many of the parents are Haitians, but many of the children are not from Haiti. They were born in Chile or in Brazil, where the parents lived and worked for years. But then because of the pandemic, because of the lockdowns in those countries, they lost from one day to another their source of income. And they could not survive. They just were running out of cash. And the only option they had was to migrate together with their children, crossing one of the most dangerous jungles in the world, heading to the U.S. in search for a better life.
So a lot to unpack there, Laurent. Let me start with the fact that a lot of these children, as you said, were born in Chile and Brazil, children of Haitian parents. I mean, just politically, how does that complicate matters as they make their way north?
I was in Haiti 2 weeks ago at the airport providing support to the families expelled from the U.S., Haitian families. And that's where I realized that when I wanted to interact with those children, we're talking about children who don't speak Creole. They don't speak the language of Haiti. They don't know the country. They were not born there. Their parents are speaking to them in Spanish or in Portuguese because they were born in Chile or in Brazil. And imagine, in terms of education, what are the chances that those kids can be sent back to school in Haiti when they don't speak the language? So that really requires a lot of coordination between all the countries involved to make sure that the children will be protected and that we will send them back to school and break the cycle of poverty, exclusion, violence, and migration.
So among the dangers that you listed, Laurent, in the jungle around the Darien Gap, the likelihood of getting separated from parents also seems high. What does that mean when the children don't have their parents looking after them in the jungle and on the route north?
It's horrible. It's a frightening experience. And we are seeing, unfortunately, more reports of babies, 2 days old, 3 days old, arriving in the reception centers where UNICEF is providing support without their parents. Typically, what is happening is that the families are living together, Colombia, but while crossing the jungle, that's the moment for one reason or another they get separated from each other. Keep in mind that we are talking about a very perilous journey where they have to cross rivers, etc. And often some of the parents get separated from their children. Then we have registered just this year over 150 children unaccompanied. And as you may imagine, a child who is unaccompanied in the middle of the jungle is an easy prey and can easily be exposed to any kind of trafficking, violence, all kinds of dangers. So what we try to do is to locate the family to see if the parents are lagging behind. And unfortunately, we also have reports of children who lost their parents during the journey and who are now orphans in Panama.
Lost them as in their parents died along the way.
Absolutely.
And you also said babies were showing up at these centers. What is the age range of these children? Are they small or some teenagers?
Half of the children crossing the border this year between Colombia and Panama are below the age of 5.
Half?
Half of them are below 5 years old. Some of those children have witnessed horrible things, extortion, robbery, and even sexual abuse on their own parents or their sisters or brothers. So we are talking about children who really come with fear in their eyes and anxiety in the eyes. They've seen some of the things no child should ever see.
So Panama is the first country these migrants end up in after they cross through Colombia and the Darien Gap. Do we know how many kids do not make it?
Well, we have registered so far 5 children who were left dead in the jungle. But as you may imagine, that's only the reported cases. Imagine how many more have not been reported and are still missing. So it is extremely dangerous, and therefore we are really calling all the countries all together to look at this issue, not just to provide humanitarian support to respond to the basic urgent needs, but it is important that we look at this issue from a coordinated approach. It's almost a continental migration issue.
So the human traffickers, they're doing this for the money, obviously. What does it cost, and what details can you share about how the traffickers operate? Do they actually accompany the kids and their families?
It's a very profitable business for the traffickers. Some of the Haitian parents were told me that they invested all their savings of years of work in Chile or in Brazil to finance their journey. They were talking about 9,000 to up to 10,000 US dollar. It's a lot of money for the whole journey. And they end up with nothing at the end of the day. So it's really worrying for them. And again, what we need to avoid is that we have a sacrificed generation, a lost generation of children, of migrant parents who don't belong anywhere and whose only hope is to end up in a criminal gang. We need to break that cycle of poverty, violence, and migration.
Laurent Duvillier is UNICEF's regional chief of communications. He's been speaking with us from Panama about the increasing number of migrant children making the dangerous journey north from South and Central America. Thank you very much, Laurent. Good to speak with you.
That was my pleasure. Have a lovely day.
So much cargo and nowhere to go. By now, you've likely seen the long lines of cargo ships choking the waters outside ports around the United States. Retailers are worrying about the supply of holiday goodies that are stuck floating in the harbor. Companies like Walmart and Home Depot are even chartering private ships to try and bypass the bottleneck. Joe Harris is a spokesman for the Port of Virginia, which is one of the busiest ports on the East Coast. He is very dialed into what's going on. How would you describe the situation in American ports right now, Joe?
I liken it to a car that has, you know, it has 100 miles an hour on its speedometer, and you can push that car to 100 miles an hour sometimes. But you can't run that automobile at 100 miles an hour every day without it beginning to break down. And our supply chain is being asked to go 100 miles an hour.
And one of the breaking points are at the ports. What are the other obstacles right now?
One of the big issues is warehousing capacity. This idea that we'll just bring the stuff in and we'll put it in a warehouse and we'll get it when we need it. You can't because the warehouses are full. Many of the manufacturers and retailers, as they saw what happened during COVID, stocked up and said, well, let's make sure that our shelves are full just in case we go through another period of COVID. So you have that, and then you have the regular business on top of that, and you have retail season on top of that.
And so does it just sit at the ports? Is that what's happening, or does it stay on the boats?
Yes and yes. Trains were pulling into various load centers, and there was nowhere to take the cargo off to, so it would sit on the train. Truck drivers. People have said, well, there are not enough truck drivers. Well, there are. There are enough truck drivers for normal operation.
So what's the problem?
Well, we're not in a normal period. Those drivers cannot work double time. They have hours of service that they have. These are federal rules that govern how long they can spend on the road. So they have to get their rest.
So you're saying the logjam with the ports and the vessels has now spread to other modes of transportation, trickled down to railroads and trucking?
Absolutely. You know, adding capacity to supply chains is expensive, and it doesn't happen quickly. So, you know, you could throw hundreds of billions of dollars at it today, but it would take years for that to materialize as far as capacity.
There are companies, as I mentioned earlier, like Walmart and Home Depot, they're actually chartering private cargo ships to get goods to stores faster. How does that make things any faster when all the ports are looking so damn crowded right now?
I have been in this business for 21 years, I think, and I have never seen or heard of a private company chartering a vessel, loading it with its containers, and pushing it to the United States. And what they're doing is they're chartering these vessels, hoping that they can push that vessel across the ocean quicker and get it in the queue quicker so that it'll go through processing at the port.
Almost sounds like the equivalent of paying somebody to wait in line for you at a concert or an event.
If they look at a port and they say, it's not congested, that's a good spot. They'll negotiate it. And that way they can land their cargo and get it moving toward its destination in the United States.
What's interesting, Joe, about the Port of Virginia where you're at is there has not been as huge a backup as at other ports. Why do you think that is?
The Port of Virginia owns, leases, and operates its assets. Because we own and operate and manage all those assets, we can be very nimble in decision-making if we see a problem coming. Not all ports have that flexibility to make those decisions. The Port of Los Angeles is much larger. I believe there are more than a dozen terminals that make up that port complex. And all of those terminals, while they share a common harbor, they are all owned and operated by different entities. So you just can't tell your neighbor, hey, I'm congested. Can you take this vessel for me while we catch up? It's simply not that easy.
So as you look to plan for the coming months, Joe, what are the variables that you're watching to see how all this is going to loosen up?
You have to go back and look at China, where it's cutting some power and it's not producing as much in manufacturing regions. So we have to look at that. You have to look at the Chinese New Year, which happens after Christmas. That's very traditional. The industry has known about it forever, and we've always planned for those 2 weeks when Chinese people take off and celebrate the New Year. You have to also plan, well, maybe there is another wave coming. So there are just lots of things to keep your eye on.
Joe Harris is a spokesman for the Port of Virginia. Joe, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Turning now to Ghana, where a proposed bill is threatening the rights of the LGBTQ community there. The bill would criminalize homosexuality and impose jail time on those who advocate on their behalf. The bill also proposes conversion therapy, an attempt to change somebody's sexual orientation. Journalist Ridwan Karim Dini Osman has been following this from Ghana for us, and he joins us from the capital, Accra. Ridwan, I gather a new group in Ghana has emerged to oppose this bill. Who are they, and what kind of clout do they have to stop this bill from actually becoming law?
Michael, so this group is called the Coalition of Lawyers, Academics, and Professionals, and it is requesting that Parliament throws out the anti-LGBTQ bill, widely described by human rights groups as a homophobe's dream. Now, the coalition argues that Ghana is a secular democracy and not a theocratic Christian or Islamic republic or an African traditional monarchy, according to the Constitution. The group also says its aim is to ensure that the rights of every citizen, be it homosexual or not, are protected. It says the proposed bill currently before Parliament has so many flaws and it is full of hate. Let's hear from Akoto Ampao, who is a private legal practitioner and a member of the coalition.
If it is passed, you can't amend it. If you try to amend it to reduce its ferocity of assault on those who are referred to as LGBTQ people, you'll be committing an offense. If you are a mother and you have a son who is a homosexual, now, this law puts a duty on that mother to report his son to the police. Is this not extremist?
So, Ridwan, what's been the reaction from those on the other side, the people pushing for this bill to be passed?
So the leader of the group of MPs that put this bill before Parliament is Sam George, who is the Member of Parliament for the Ningo Pram-Pram constituency. He has essentially rubbished the arguments advanced by this group, accusing them of hypocrisy. Now, let's take a listen to what more he had to say in response to the group's memo against this bill.
Homosexuality or sexual preference is not a right as guaranteed by the 1992 Constitution. If majority of us have taken a position that we are not tolerant of accepting sexual preference and perversion, we have the same right to take that position.
So largely, the religious community in Ghana is unanimous in terms of its support for this anti-LGBTQ bill. However, what is interesting is the latest by the Church of Pentecost in the country. Now, in the church's a memorandum to Parliament, it argues it has 2 million members in the country and that they will hit the streets to fight anyone that opposes the bill. It also threatened to vote out the current government if it fails to give the bill a pass. Here is the national chairman of the Church of Pentecost, Apostle Eric Nyameche.
But we are going to cause our people to come on the street, and we are going to warn any government that if you vote against this bill, we will vote you out. And that is it. There's no room for neutrality. What I'm saying is not political. It's about the future of the nation.
Well, it really seems that the sides are drawn in Ghana over this bill. Ridwan, how many of these memos have been received either for or against this bill that would criminalize homosexuality? And what are we looking at as a timeline?
Well, the bill is currently before Parliament's Constitutional, Legal and Parliamentary Affairs Committee. However, the window for the receipt of these memos was closed last Friday. What we do understand is that they have received more than 150 memos in total. Parliament has been on recess since July and resumes later this month. There are suggestions that the controversial bill may be on top of the agenda.
So what is the likelihood that this bill will pass in Parliament and become law? What are experts saying?
Well, the support for this bill far exceeds those who are against it. the Speaker of Parliament, the leadership on both sides of the House are for this bill. Now, the LGBT community has meanwhile adopted a wait-and-see approach as they continue to call on the global community to intervene. Now, if the bill is passed by Parliament, the President can either decide to ignore critics and sign it or veto it, something analysts and diplomats say he may be unwilling to do, given the widespread support for anti-LGBT legislation in Ghana.
Journalist Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra speaking with us about a new bill that seeks to criminalize homosexuality in Ghana. Ridwan, thank you for your time.
Always a pleasure, Marco.
Dozens of U.S. ambassador appointments are languishing in the Senate right now, which means at embassies and at the State Department in D.C., there are empty desks gathering dust with each day that passes. That's according to the Partnership for Public Service in Washington, where my next guest, Lauren DeYoung Shulman, is vice president. Your organization tracks political appointments in Washington. Lauren, how many positions are currently unfilled at the State Department?
Just to say up front, all of these roles have somebody who is sitting at the desk technically. They're an acting position, they're a holdover, they're a civil servant who is doing their best in a temporary position. But right now, pending in the Senate, we have 65 ambassador nominations that are waiting for the Senate to take any action on them to move them forward. And then beyond that, overall, when you look at the State Department in total, there are actually 79 nominees that are pending. We have only two ambassadors, one to the United Nations, one the ambassador to Mexico, have been confirmed and are in place for this administration.
It really is stunning. One of the reasons for the holdups is Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. He's on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which oversees these appointments. The New York Times and others are reporting that Cruz is protesting the Biden White House for removing sanctions over this Russian gas pipeline, Nord Stream 2. It's a controversial energy project that has pitted Russia against U.S. allies in Europe. Former President Trump put sanctions on the firms that are building Nord Stream 2 because he said the gas pipeline would give Vladimir Putin muscle over Europe. How exactly has Cruz been able to slow down these appointments?
Senator Cruz is putting holds, effectively, on all nominees from the State Department. That requires Senate leaders, Senator Schumer, to say, all right, I'm going to make a motion to cloture. But that requires taking an extra floor time and having roll call votes that they otherwise would not usually have to have. And I don't know if you've noticed, but the Senate has a lot on its plate these days. So this is just adding one more thing that they have to spend valuable time on where they might have otherwise been on the debt limit, the infrastructure bill, and other things.
Are Cruz's actions the biggest holdup right now?
I think tactically, they absolutely are. We would be much further along in the nomination process and confirmation process for all agencies if it wasn't for Senator Cruz's action. But realistically, this is also about Senate choices. And it's also something the Biden administration could put more priority on themselves. It may be that this is insurmountable politically, that the Biden administration doesn't want to give in to whatever Senator Cruz's asks are. But this isn't the end of the story. There are other folks who can be involved and apply more priority and actually move some of these nominations through.
What are the major countries without ambassadors right now? And what are the consequences of having those unfilled positions?
So folks may remember recently there was a relatively big crisis in U.S.-France relations due to a deal that the United States was forming with Australia and the U.K. on nuclear issues. We don't have ambassadors to the U.K., we don't have ambassadors to France, and we don't have an ambassador to Australia. All of that hubbub would probably have been easier if we'd had an ambassador in place. Similarly, in the withdrawal from Afghanistan, no ambassador to Afghanistan, no ambassador to many of the countries that are being sent Afghan refugees, and no ambassador to NATO and many of the European partners who have worked with us for so long in Afghanistan, who could have been a part of a stronger engagement strategy as we were making our decisions on pulling out. Beyond that, the European Union, China, Japan, India, we're falling significantly behind in our ability to actually make progress on Biden's agenda in these countries.
Is this just another casualty of a lack of bipartisanship in Washington, or is something else going on here, Lauren?
There's been an increase in the number of holds placed on nominees for Senate-confirmed positions over the last several administrations. This didn't really happen much before the Clinton administration, and those motions have, I think, either tripled or quadrupled in the last several years. The fact that we are now in the Senate willing to hold up nominees to these critical roles tells me that foreign policy and national security is no longer exempt. It is now part of this incredibly polarized churn that goes on in the Senate that is not just about making progress on policy, but about inhibiting progress from political adversaries in whatever their agenda may be.
Is there a timeline you're looking at, Lauren, where this becomes existentially counterproductive for U.S. diplomacy? I mean, how does this get resolved?
I think there's a few big picture questions that the Senate and the administration should be asking themselves. We are one of the only countries that actually puts all of its ambassadors through this process. Many of our peers just name their ambassadors and send them to other countries. Long term, I think we should revisit whether or not all of these roles truly do require the Senate's advising consent power, particularly if they're not willing to actually execute it. Shorter term, though, I think that the Biden administration is going to have to look long and hard at its foreign policy agenda and say, what can we actually execute in the absence of having people in these roles? And to what degree do we need to go to the Senate and ask them to prioritize this? All of that is politics. But until the Senate decides that this is once again part of their primary responsibilities, it's going to have to be reframed in terms of how we look at this in political debate.
Lauren DeYoung-Schulman is with the Partnership for Public Service, which tracks political appointments. She's been speaking with us from Washington. Thank you very much for your time, Lauren.
Thank you.
The pandemic knows no boundaries. Neither does research into the coronavirus, thanks to a global network of scientists from Argentina to the Congo. They're sharing data about the virus to understand new variants that are circulating.
This means that we participate in the game. We are able to say what is circulating.
Be with us tomorrow on The World for our story on the global race to get ahead of the coronavirus. We close today's program with a series of chance encounters that led to this musical inspiration from Sierra Leone. The country, as you know, was ravaged by civil war in the 1990s. Musician Sori Kandi lived through those hostilities. He was born blind in Freetown, the capital, and taught himself to play thumb piano. While playing in the town of Lungi, he happened to meet an American recording engineer that led to Kandi's first studio album. Fast forward a few years, and through another chance encounter, along with a few bootleg remixes on cassette, Sori Kandi came to the attention of LA-based producer Chief Boima, a Sierra Leonean American. Together, they created the Kandi Band and toured the U.S. and the U.K. One more chance encounter brought London producer Will Horrocks into the band. Now the Kandi Band is a trio with a new album, We Famous. Here's a track that asks the question, a deep one, that I know a lot of people are asking, how will it be for me in this world? A lot of uncertainty in the answer, but for Sori Kandi and his collaborators in the Kandi Band right now, things have been and continue to look up. Comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We hope to see you tomorrow.